KALW. From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Glen Park.
Rockridge.
I live in West Alameda.
Montclair.
Coming up, it can seem like homelessness is a growing problem in San Francisco.
I mean, I see shanty towns. We're essentially developing these tent cities.
But in fact, the population of people living on the streets has been the same for years. So if the numbers aren't changing, what is? Then we'll hear about a new show introducing kids to Harriet Tubman through opera.
All the kids were, whoa, what was that? And they were like, whoa, I like opera.
And going back to Africa to discover a disturbing past.
It just feels so unfathomable that you could even see a place like this and continue to perpetrate these atrocities.
That's all today on Cross Currents. KALW reporter Liza Veal says when people find out she reports on housing and homelessness, their first response is that homelessness has been increasing recently. Turns out this is a common assumption.
If you had to guess, would you say that the number of homeless people has been growing in the past couple of years?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, for sure.
I think it's definitely getting worse.
Yeah, so I'd say the number has been growing.
In 2016, residents called 311 to complain about encampments five times more than in the previous year. But what's confusing is the population of homeless people in San Francisco has actually stayed relatively flat. So if the numbers aren't changing, what is? Well, three things. Here's Liza Veal.
I asked San Franciscans what gave them the impression that homelessness was growing.
It just seems the tents along the freeway.
I mean, I see what the equivalent is of shanty towns. We're essentially developing these tent cities.
This is not an illusion. The number of homeless people isn't changing, but the number of tents definitely is. It was back at the end of 2015 that they really began proliferating. Back then, I reported about a crew of San Franciscans, known to some as the Tent Mafia, who'd gotten angry watching the Department of Public Works trashing tents. And so they crowdsourced money to hand out new ones to people without.
Hey, do you need a tent?
Thank you, appreciate that.
Just one person there? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
The head organizer, Sean Osborne, told me back then, when they kicked off the campaign.
Within the first few hours, we managed to raise over $4,000.
There was an outpouring of support that translated into thousands of tents and then tapered off. The whole operation wrapped this past October. But of course, the Tent Mafia isn't responsible for all the tents. In cities up and down the West Coast, charity groups handed them out, and when municipalities tried to clear them like trash, they got community blowback. Now tents are a fixture. There's another reason why homelessness is more visible in San Francisco: development. With so much building going on, there are just fewer secluded places for people to live out of sight. Mohamed Nuru is director of San Francisco's Department of Public Works.
With all the construction downtown, you know, the Transbay Terminal, the whole of Mission Bay development, you know, the eastern waterfront, the booming construction has displaced a lot of people.
People who lived in alleys and parking lots away from the foot traffic, and also people that lived in cheap rooms that were redeveloped and then ended up on the street. Nuru takes a lot of pride in being the number one groundskeeper of what he sees as a beautiful city.
Our goal is to make sure that our city is presentable at all times. Things need to look very clean, things need to look green, more flowers, nice mediums, beautiful buildings. That's a reflection of a healthy city.
He says he believes in a zero-tolerance approach to people living on the streets, and it's his department that disbands and clears out tent cities. Still, he's glad that development has made homelessness more visible, because this way it's easier to connect people to services.
Because at least we can see the people now and we can interact with them. A lot of the population we're talking about has been out on the street for a while. And I think what the city is doing is trying to bring everybody together to try to find the right place for these individuals.
One man who introduced himself as Wyndon used to live in China Basin. It was pretty secluded, he says, until construction sent him on the move. Now he doesn't want to live in a tent encampment.
I'd rather stay alone by myself and mind my own business and, you know, leave others alone. But...
feel safer that way? Or...
mainly, yeah, yes.
He tried to live in Golden Gate Park, but felt unsafe.
Well, it's dark. You can't see a thing. You know, unless you got a dog, he can help you.
So now he's in Potrero Hill by the freeway, the only tent on the block, one of the last remaining places where he can get some space without being in anyone else's. So why does it seem like there's more homelessness even though the numbers don't bear that out? Development has pushed people out of seclusion onto the streets, and tent encampments have led to a street life that draws attention. How do these changes actually impact the people that live on the streets?
It's getting more people and it's getting worser.
This man, Curtis, says he recently got a spot in an SRO hotel. He's actually carrying a potted plant he plans to bring home. He's glad to not be living out here anymore.
A lot of people on drugs, and it'd be a lot of stuff going on. People get stabbed and people be stealing from each other, fights. People be raping the women and then they be raping the homosexuals. Tough guys, you know what I'm saying? That don't be cool.
But for other people, the encampments are just about the only stability in their lives. Take this woman, Rachel.
Actually, I think it's probably better than I would have imagined. Because, I don't know, we're kind of like a little community here. We try to watch out for each other. And I've met a lot of nice people.
The last big factor explaining why the number of homeless people isn't growing, despite all appearances, is this. Certain segments of the homeless population are growing, while others are shrinking. And the group that's shrinking is the least visible, homeless families. That's where the city is focusing its efforts. That's Aiko. We're in her brand new apartment in Richmond.
I feel like this wall-to-wall carpeting is perfect for her.
She loves it. Yeah. Oh, she loves it. She's never been on carpet before, so.
That's Aiko's mom, Mianta. They just moved in last week, so the apartment is clean and bare. It's a one-bedroom for her, her baby, and her father, Aiko's grandfather.
She's happy. She has space to run around, and I don't feel like, oh, you gotta have shoes on, you gotta have socks on, don't lay on the floor, don't touch this, don't touch that.
Mianta is one of the nearly 1,000 families the city has helped house in the last 3 years.
Want to stand up?
Have a seat.
Look at your perspective.
When Mianta applied for rent support, she was living in a temporary transitional housing facility, like a halfway house. This was after 17 years in prison.
I was a teenager when I went to jail and had never lived on my own as an adult.
She was pregnant with Aiko and working two jobs, but she worried about making rent once her lease at the facility was up, with a new baby.
I had to find something to take her home to before she was born, because she deserves to be born into a space that is like a home, not, we don't know where we're going.
In transitional housing and pregnant, Mianta was really vulnerable to becoming homeless. But a nonprofit called Hamilton Families stepped in to temporarily cover her rent. It's part of their rapid rehousing program. See, even though Mianta wasn't on the street, living in the facility meant she was counted as a sheltered but homeless person. In 2014, the city of San Francisco partnered with Hamilton Families to scale up that rapid rehousing program with the goal of assisting people before things fall apart and homelessness locks in.
Any family that experiences a housing crisis won't be exposed to that crisis for any longer than 90 days.
Tamika Moss is the director of Hamilton Families.
We had a doubling of family homelessness in San Francisco past the recession. Many of these families are not unsheltered. They are living with relatives, sleeping on couches, etc. And so that's part of why you don't see the visibility of family homelessness in particular that you do with single adults.
San Francisco also has an initiative to house the roughly 1,300 families that have been homeless for a long time. One big way the city is housing more people is by looking outside its own housing stock at other cities.
We know that if a family is homeless in San Francisco, but we can find them an affordable unit in Sacramento, they're often going to make the choice to move to Sacramento. This all just sort of happened in the last 3 years. We were housing 75% of our families in San Francisco for the last decades, forever. And then the last 3 years, that has flipped.
Mianta's family is one of the ones that moved out of San Francisco with assistance from Hamilton Families. And that was 2 years ago. She's been covering rent on her own for a year. And this new apartment is an upgrade she's making.
It feels safe. It feels clean. It feels like a home.
Mianta is not worried about backsliding. She's a go-getter. She was a teenager when she went to prison, and she worked as an organizer during her incarceration. And now she's employed as an advocate with Justice Now. So the number of homeless people in San Francisco hasn't changed in over 5 years. But in most cities around the country and the Bay Area, the numbers definitely are rising. And there are still over 4,000 people living on the streets of San Francisco, plus another 3,000 in shelters. In San Francisco, I'm Liza Veal for Cross Currents.
Liza is KALW's housing and homelessness reporter. You can reach out to her at housing@klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Since 2013, San Francisco's Opera Parallel partners with local schools to create and perform an original opera. The world premiere of this year's show is this week. It's called Harriet's Spirit, about a young girl struggling with bullying, and she gets advice from Harriet Tubman. The show's composed by jazz great Marcus Shelby and features students from Rooftop Alternative School. Jazz opera singer Tiffany Austin plays Harriet Tubman, and Aaron Neff, the show's director, came to KALW Studios to talk with Jen Chien about working with kids and finding their own inspiration in Harriet Tubman.
Could one of you, maybe you, Aaron, can you tell me a little bit more about the story?
So the show opens with a young woman, a middle schooler, who is walking home from school, and she's looking at, very proudly, her book report that she's made about Harriet Tubman. And in the midst of walking home, she's suddenly confronted with bullies. And they jostle her up, physically harass her, and she hits her head. And when she comes to, she is seeing Harriet Tubman. And so this opera is an odd mix of historically what Harriet Tubman did, plus this aspect of bullying, and how this girl finds Harriet Tubman's strength in herself to overcome and confront bullying. Marcus Shelby's score is phenomenal. If you like jazz and if you like opera, it's wonderful. Great for kids, great for adults.
Everybody.
Everybody.
Tiffany, you're also known as a jazz singer. What's it been like for you to work in opera? You're also classically trained, is that right?
That is right. Yeah, it's been actually kind of a homecoming. When I was growing up, I was classically trained, and I used to try to sing pop music and soul music with classical approach and wonder what was going so terribly wrong. When I first heard that I was going to be playing Harriet Tubman, I was terrified because she's just such an influential figure. Personally, I think about my grandmother. My grandmother came up in the rural South, and she used to tell the stories that were, you know, pretty horrific.
Do you think about your grandmother consciously as you're performing?
Definitely, and I think that, you know, it started when I started developing my jazz voice and digging into the blues and realizing that we have to call on the ancestors for that spirit. You can't take art in a vacuum. It would be a disservice.
And I'm wondering what's it been like working with middle school kids.
It's been fun, particularly since these kids are not performers per se. They volunteer to do it. The people who are there really want to be there. So that has been amazing.
And they're not just extras, right? They sing, they have characters, they're an integral part of the story.
They're a huge part of the story.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of great energy that they have. I think that the excitement is kind of infectious. Especially, you know, early in the morning after, you know, a 2-hour drive in the traffic, and you get there and you see their faces, and yeah, it wakes you up and it makes you excited.
I'm wondering also, for the kids and also for both of you, we talked a little bit about this idea of being more fluid between genres, but this jazz and opera, and it's neither of those two are genres that middle schoolers these days are super into, I would think. So has there been any resistance, or how have you gone about trying to transfer your love of this type of music?
I think for me, it's just to embody the music and not to treat it as a rehearsal or even as a performance. For me, it's just a moment of communication. I just want to kind of open myself up and be an example for the children, rather maybe than saying something explicitly.
Sometimes that goes the opposite direction.
Yeah.
You want it to.
Lectures,
at that age.
Yeah. Lectures get lost.
I would say that before Tiffany and Christabel started coming to rehearsals.
And Christabel, who plays Modesty.
Who so plays Modesty.
The younger character.
The kids, I don't think, grasped fully what they were singing and the style of it. Because the day Tiffany and Christabel showed up, all the kids were, whoa, what was that? Really impressed.
Just the power of their voices.
The power of it. And they were like, whoa, I like opera. I didn't know I liked opera. They literally stopped singing and doing any acting as soon as the two soloists opened their mouths. It was great.
That's very cute. Do either of you have a favorite moment from the show?
There's so many good moments. Okay, let's see. I think one of my favorite moments is the duet between Modesty and Harriet, where they're talking about freedom, and you can see them moving toward each other, really feeling hopeful in all this darkness and all this confusion and all this bullying, that they still have that hope, that light inside of them, that there's going to be freedom at the end of this.
That's also one of my favorite scenes, particularly because it starts with a conversation about fear.
Mm.
Where Modesty is asking, weren't you ever afraid? And Harriet responds, why, yes, of course. I was terrified. But if you listen to fear, fear is very intelligent. If you really listen to it, if you run away from it, it's not very smart. But if you listen to it and can respond in an intelligent way, and this will lead to the freedom.
Mm.
So that scene is really beautiful. And I think it sets the tone for the whole opera, which is the process of the kids, right? These kids who are bullying, really, those kids are afraid. They don't know they're afraid. This is how they are manifesting their fear. And they come to this place of challenging their own actions.
That was Tiffany Austin and Aaron Neff speaking with KALW's Jen Sheehan. Jackie Sajiko produced the interview. The music you heard was by Tiffany Austin and composer Marcus Shelby. Harriet's Spirit is premiering this week at the Burial Clay Theater in San Francisco. Shows are on January 18th and 20th. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. Our last segment today comes from The Stoop, a podcast on Black identity hosted by me and reporter Leela Day.
The Stoop.
The Stoop.
The Stoop.
The Stoop.
Stories about Black identity that aren't always shared in the open.
Shh, girl, we can't say that.
It's like a griot,
a hair salon,
a newsroom,
and your mama's kitchen all in one.
So despite this image of Africa still as a poverty and war-stricken desperate place, or that word allegedly used by our president, in recent years, African immigrants have actually been moving back to the continent. More and more people have started going back in the past decades. Repats, they call them. When researchers surveyed African immigrants here in the U.S. on whether they'd eventually go back home, 80% said yes, they would, if they could. And the reasons? Well, one is opportunity, jobs, also family and lifestyle. But oftentimes, going back is tricky, especially for people who grew up here in the U.S. You go back, and maybe you feel you don't belong there anymore, or you learn things that completely change you. That's what happened to Berkeley author Yah Jessie, the Ghanaian-American award-winning author of the novel Homegoing. She says growing up in Huntsville, Alabama, she always wanted to be a writer, as we hear in this excerpt from the Stoop episode called Back to Africa.
Butterfly in the sky.
The first story I ever wrote, I wrote when I was 7 for the Reading Rainbow Young Writers and Illustrators
Reading
Competition.
Rainbow.
LeVar Burton signed my certificate and sent it back, and I feel like that was the first kind of stamp of approval for this profession. A reading rainbow.
So it was going back to a very specific place in Ghana that changed Ya.
There's a door that actually says the door of no return. And when you open that, it leads out onto the beach. And then the ships would be waiting from there to take them on to wherever they were about to spend the rest of their lives as slaves. And the tour guide spoke to us about things like the British soldiers marrying the local women. And then he also took us down to see the dungeons. But he also spoke very frankly about the different roles that the ethnic groups in the Gold Coast at the time played in the slave trade. And he spoke about it so freely and in a way that I hadn't really heard before, because though I knew it, it was also the kind of thing that people spoke about in whispers.
What was it like standing there?
Truly harrowing, I think. Probably the most rage and grief that I've ever felt, you know, all at once. It's hard to imagine keeping people in a room like that dungeon for, you know, months at a time, and I only had to stand in there for 5 minutes and felt, you know, totally uncomfortable.
Was your rage and anger for the slaves who ended up in the U.S. being African American slaves, or was it more anger against the people who were complicit from West Africa, from Ghana?
Oh, it was both. It was all of it. I mean, it was just it just feels so unfathomable that you could even see a place like this and continue to perpetrate these atrocities against people. You know, how did it last as long as it did?
It was this trip back to Ghana, a place Ya hadn't been since she was 2 years old, that set the stage for her novel, Homegoing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in this story, Hana, in Homegoing, it gets straight to your gut.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a story about two half-sisters, and they're torn apart to live two very different lives.
By the time Efia had reached age 10, she could recite a history of the scars on her body. For each scar on Efia's body, there was a companion scar on Baba's.
One sister is sold into slavery and ends up in the U.S. And the other sister, you know, she just continues her life in Ghana. And the book follows each sister for 7 generations.
I would say the research is when I felt, you know, sad and angry and all of that. But when I was writing, I at least got to console myself with the fact that it was fiction, and I was making these people up. And you can't do that when you're reading about real people's lives.
And Leela, that research she's talking about that made her so sad was, she went back and she learned about the slave trade.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she learned about Ghanaian tribes competing in catching slaves to sell to the British who were conducting the slave trade there. And it was really painful for her to learn about this history.
When I told my parents what I was working on and asked them if they had learned about any of this in school, they said no. So my impression is that at least, you know, when my parents were coming up, that it wasn't something that was taught in schools in the same way that we in America at least do have, you know, a chapter on slavery in our history classes.
I mean, I think that's right for many people who've had to kind of discover their ancestors' ugly histories,
mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, like in Sudan, there's a slave trade history with Arab slave trade happening in East Africa across the continent from where Ya is.
But it's not a conversation that's usually had like it is here in the United States, right? Like neither me nor my parents learned any of this. In school, it's just not in the textbooks. And for Yah Jesse, learning about all this, I mean, it really was life-changing.
A lot of that experience was really formative and enlightening, but one thing that I think visiting the castle really did for me was, first of all, give me the idea for this book, but it also just felt like a way to kind of talk about slavery more fully, more holistically than I had ever seen it talked about before.
That was an excerpt from the episode Back to Africa from the podcast The Stoop, hosted by me and Leela Day. You can hear the full episode at thestoop.org, including more stories of immigrants who moved back to Africa. Today's local music is by pianist Graham Richards. You can catch him perform tunes from a variety of genres at the Legionnaire Saloon. That's in Oakland every Tuesday and Thursday at 6 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.